chronic care hospital for patients in the Bronx. Here, my attention was immediately drawn to a number of strangely immobile, sometimes entranced-looking patients, the post-encephalitic survivors I was later to write about in Awakenings. There were nearly 80 of them at the time. I saw them in the lobby, in the corridors, as well as on the wards, sometimes in strange postures, absolutely motionless, frozen in a trance-like state. A few of these patients, rather than being frozen, were in the opposite state, one of almost continuous driven activity, all their movements accelerated, excessive and explosive. All of them, I discovered, were victims of encephalitis lethargica, the epidemic sleeping sickness that swept the globe just after World War I, and some had been in this frozen state since they had entered the hospital 40 or more years before. In 1966, there was no medication of any use to these patients, no medication at least for their frozenness, their Parkinsonian motionlessness. And yet, it was common knowledge among the nurses and staff that these patients could move on occasion, with an ease and grace that seemed to belie their Parkinsonism, and that the most potent occasioner of such movement was, in fact, music. Typically, these post-encephalitic patients, like people with ordinary Parkinsonism, could not easily initiate anything, and yet often they were able to respond. Many could catch and return a ball if it was thrown, and almost all of them tended to respond in some way to music. Some of them could not initiate a single step, but could be drawn into dancing and could dance fluidly. Some could scarcely utter a syllable. Their voices, when they could speak, lacked tone, lacked force, were almost spectral. But these patients were able to sing, on occasion, loudly and clearly, with full vocal force and a normal range of expressiveness and tone. Other patients could walk and talk, but only in a jerky, broken way, without a steady tempo, and sometimes with incontinent accelerations. With such patients, music could modulate the stream of movement or speech, giving them the steadiness and control they so lacked. Though music therapy was hardly a profession in the 1960s, Beth Abraham, most unusually, had its own music therapist, a dynamo called Kitty Stiles. It was only when she died in her late 90s that I realized she must already have been over 80 when I met her, but she had the vitality of a much younger person. Kitty had a special feeling for our post-encephalitic patients, and in the decades before drugs, such as L-Dopa, were available, it was only Kitty and her music which could bring them to life. Indeed, when we came to make a documentary film about these patients in 1973, the film's director, Duncan Dallas, immediately asked me, "Can I meet the music therapist? She seems to be the most important person around here." So she was, in the days before L-Dopa, and so she continued to be when the effects of L-Dopa became, in many patients, erratic and unstable. While the power of music has been known for millennia, the idea of formal music therapy arose only during the First and Second World Wars, when large numbers of wounded soldiers were gathered in veterans' hospitals, and it was found that their pain and misery, and even, seemingly, some of their physiological responses, pulse rates, blood pressure, and so on, could be improved by music. Doctors and nurses in many veterans' hospitals started to invite musicians to come and play for their patients, and musicians were only too happy to bring music to the dreadful wards of the wounded. But it was soon evident that enthusiasm and generosity were not enough. Some professional training was needed as well. The first formal music therapy program was set up in 1944 at Michigan State University, and the National Association for Music Therapy was formed in 1950. But music therapy remained, for the next quarter of a century, scarcely recognized. I do not know whether Kitty Stiles, our music therapist at Beth Abraham, had any formal training or was licensed as a music therapist, but she had an immense intuitive gift for divining what could get patients going, however regressed or disabled they might appear. Working with individual patients calls upon empathy and personal interaction as much as any formal therapy, and Kitty was very skilled at this. She was also an audacious improviser and very playful, both on the keyboard and in life. Without this, I suspect, many of her efforts would have been futile. I once invited the poet W.H. Auden to one of Kitty's sessions, and he was amazed by the instant transformations which music could effect. They reminded him of an aphorism of the German romantic writer Novalis. Every disease is a musical problem. Every cure is a musical solution. This seemed almost literally to be the case with these profoundly Parkinsonian patients. Parkinsonism is usually called a movement disorder, though when it is severe, it is not only movement that is affected, but the flow of perception, thought, and feeling as well. The disorder of flow can take many forms. Sometimes, as the term kinetic stutter implies, there is not a smooth flow of movement, but brokenness, jerkiness, starts and stops instead. Parkinsonian stutter, like verbal stuttering, can respond beautifully to the rhythm and flow of music, as long as the music is of the right kind, and the right kind is unique for every patient. For one of my post-encephalitic patients, Francis D., music was as powerful as any drug. 1 minute, I would see her compressed, clenched, and blocked, or else jerking, ticking, and jabbering, like a sort of human time bomb. The next minute, if we played music for her, all of these explosive obstructive phenomena would disappear, replaced by a blissful ease and flow of movement, as Mrs. D., suddenly freed of her automatisms, would smilingly conduct the music or rise and dance to it. But it was necessary for her that the music be legato. Staccato, percussive music might have a bizarre counter-effect, causing her to jump and jerk helplessly with the beat, like a mechanical doll or marionette. In general, the right music for Parkinsonian patients is not only legato, but has a well-defined rhythm. If, on the other hand, the rhythm is too loud, dominating, or intrusive, patients may find themselves helplessly driven or entrained by it. The power of music in Parkinsonism is not, however, dependent on familiarity or even enjoyment, though in general music works best if it is both familiar and liked. Another patient, Edith T., a former music teacher, spoke of her need for music. She said that she had become graceless with the onset of Parkinsonism, that her movements had become wooden, mechanical, like a robot or doll. She had lost her former naturalness and musicality of movement. In short, she said, she had been unmusicked by her Parkinsonism. But when she found herself stuck or frozen, even the imagining of music might restore the power of action to her. Now, as she put it, she could dance out of the frame, the flat frozen landscape in which she was trapped, and move freely and gracefully. It was like suddenly remembering myself, my own living tune. But then, just as suddenly, the inner music would cease, and she would fall once again into the abyss of Parkinsonism. Equally dramatic, and perhaps in some way analogous, was Edith's ability to use, to share, other people's ambulatory abilities. She could easily and automatically walk with another person, falling into their rhythm, their tempo, sharing their kinetic melody. But the moment they stopped, she would stop too. The movements and perceptions of people with Parkinsonism are often too fast or too slow, though they may not be aware of this. They may be able to infer it only when they compare themselves to clocks or to other people. The neurologist William Goody described this in his book Time and the Nervous System. An observer may note how slowed a Parkinsonian's movements are, but the patient will say, "My own movements seem normal to me unless I see how long they take by looking at a clock. The clock on the wall of the ward seems to be going exceptionally fast." Goody wrote of the sometimes enormous disparities such patients can show between personal time and clock time. I discussed this and other disorders of time in my 2004 essay, Speed. But if music is present, its tempo and speed take precedence over the Parkinsonism and allow Parkinsonian patients to return, while the music lasts, to their own rate of moving, that which was natural for them before their illness. Music indeed resists all attempts at hurrying or slowing and imposes its own tempo. I saw this recently at a recital by the eminent and now Parkinsonian composer and conductor Lucas Foss. He rocketed almost uncontrollably to the piano, but once there, played a Chopin nocturne with exquisite control and timing and grace, only to festinate once again as soon as the music ended. This power of music was invaluable with one extraordinary post-encephalitic patient, Ed M., whose movements were too fast on the right side of his body and too slow on the left side. We could not find any good way to medicate him, for whatever improved one side would worsen the other. But he loved music, and he had a small organ in his room. With this, and this only, when he sat down and played, he could bring his two hands, his two sides, together in unison and synchrony. A fundamental problem in Parkinsonism is the inability to initiate movement spontaneously. Parkinsonian patients are always getting stuck or frozen. Normally, there is a virtually instantaneous commensuration between our intentions and the subcortical machinery, the basal ganglia especially, that allows their automatic inaction. Gerald Edelman, in The Remembered Present, refers to the basal ganglia, along with the cerebellum and hippocampus, as the organs of succession, but it is the basal ganglia especially which are damaged in Parkinsonism. If the damage is very severe, the Parkinsonian may be reduced to virtual immobility and silence, not paralyzed, but in a sense locked in, unable by himself to initiate any movement, and yet perfectly able to respond to certain stimuli. The Parkinsonian is stuck, so to speak, in a subcortical box, and can only emerge from this, as Luria brings out, with the help of an outside stimulus. Thus, Parkinsonian patients can be called into action, sometimes by something as simple as throwing them a ball, though once they catch the ball or throw it back, they will freeze again. To enjoy any real sense of freedom, a longer release, they need something which can last over time, and the most potent unlocker here is music. This was very clear with Rosalie B., a post-encephalitic lady who tended to remain transfixed for hours each day, completely motionless, frozen, usually with one finger stuck to her spectacles. If one walked her down the hallway, she would walk in a passive wooden way, with her finger still stuck to her spectacles. But she was very musical and loved to play the piano. As soon as she sat down on the piano bench, her stuck hand came down to the keyboard, and she would play with ease and fluency, her face, usually frozen in an inexpressive Parkinsonian mask, full of expression and feeling. Music liberated her from her Parkinsonism for a time, and not only playing music, but imagining it. Rosalie knew all of Chopin by heart, and we had only to say, Opus 49, to see her whole body, posture, and expression change, her Parkinsonism vanishing as the F minor fantasy played itself in her mind. Her EEG, too, would become normal at such times. If Rosalie could imagine music so effectively as to normalize her EEG, why did she not do this all the while? Why did she remain helpless and transfixed for most of the day? What she lacked, as all patients with Parkinsonism lack to some extent, was not the power of imagination, but the power to initiate mental or physical action. Thus, by saying Opus 49, we initiated matters, and all she had to do was respond. But without such a cue or stimulus, nothing would have happened. Ivan Vaughan, a Cambridge psychologist who developed Parkinson's disease, wrote a memoir about living with the disease, and Jonathan Miller directed a 1984 BBC documentary, Ivan, broadcast as part of the Horizon series based on this. In both the book and the film, Ivan describes a variety of ingenious, indirect stratagems for getting himself going, which he could not do by sheer will. Thus, for example, he would allow his eyes to wander when he woke up, until he caught sight of a tree painted on the wall by his bed. This would act as a stimulus, in effect saying, "Climb me," and by imagining himself climbing, Ivan could climb out of bed, a simple act which he was unable to do directly. When I came to Beth Abraham in 1966, music was chiefly provided by the indefatigable Kitty Stiles, who spent dozens of hours each week at the hospital. Sometimes there was music from a record player or radio, though Kitty herself seemed to have a stimulating power of her own. Recorded music was not portable at this time. Battery-powered radios and tape recorders were still large and heavy. Now, of course, everything has changed, and we can have hundreds of tunes on an iPod the size and weight of a matchbook. While the extreme availability of music may have its own dangers, I wonder whether brainworms or musical hallucinations are more common now. This availability is an unmitigated boon for those with Parkinsonism. While most of the patients I see are the severely disabled residents of chronic care hospitals and nursing homes, I get letters from many Parkinsonian people who are still relatively independent and living at home, perhaps with a little help. Recently, Carolina Yaney, a psychologist in Albuquerque, wrote to tell me about her mother, who, because of Parkinson's disease, had had great difficulty walking. "I made up a goofy little song," the daughter wrote, "called Walkin' Mama, that included a finger-snapping beat. I have a rotten voice, but she liked hearing it. She would play it with the tape recorder hooked on her waistband and earphones. It really seemed to help her navigate around the house." Nietzsche was intensely interested throughout his life in the relationship of art, and especially music, to physiology. He spoke of its tonic effect, its power of arousing the nervous system in a general way, especially during states of physiological and psychological depression. He was himself often depressed, physiologically and psychologically, by severe migraines. He also spoke of the dynamic or propulsive powers of music, its ability to elicit, to drive, and to regulate movement. Rhythm, he felt, could propel and articulate the stream of movement, and the stream of emotion and thought, which he saw as no less dynamic or motoric than the purely muscular. And rhythmic vitality and exuberance, he thought, expressed itself most naturally in the form of dance. He called his own philosophizing dancing in chains, and thought the strongly rhythmic music of Bizet as ideally suited to this. He would often take his notebook to Bizet concerts. He wrote, "Bizet makes me a better philosopher." I had read Nietzsche's notes on physiology and art as a student many years before, but his concise and brilliant formulations in The Will to Power came alive for me only when I came to Beth Abraham and saw the extraordinary powers of music with our post-encephalitic patients, its power to awaken them at every level, to alertness when they were lethargic, to normal movements when they were frozen, and, most uncannily, to vivid emotions and memories, fantasies, whole identities which were, for the most part, unavailable to them. Music did everything that L. Dopa, still in the future, was subsequently to do, and more, but only for the brief span while it lasted, and perhaps for a few minutes afterwards. Metaphorically, it was like auditory dopamine, a prosthesis for the damaged basal ganglia. It is music that the Parkinsonian needs, for only music, which is rigorous yet spacious, sinuous and alive, can evoke responses that are equally so. And he needs not only the metrical structure of rhythm and the free movement of melody, its contours and trajectories, its ups and downs, its tensions and relaxations, but the will and intentionality of music to allow him to regain the freedom of his own kinetic melody. Chapter 21. Phantom Fingers. The Case of the One-Armed Pianist. Some years ago I received a letter from Erna Otten, a piano student who had once studied with the Viennese pianist Paul Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein, she explained, had lost his right arm in World War I. I had many occasions to see how involved his right stump was whenever we went over the fingering for a new composition. He told me many times that I should trust his choice of fingering because he felt every finger of his right hand. At times I had to sit very quietly while he would close his eyes and his stump would move constantly in an agitated manner. This was many years after the loss of his arm. As a postscript, she added, his finger choice was always the best. The varied phenomena of phantom limbs were first explored in detail by the physician Silas Weir Mitchell during the Civil War, when great numbers of veterans came to the many hospitals established to treat their wounds, including what was known as the Stump Hospital in Philadelphia. Weir Mitchell, a novelist as well as a neurologist, was fascinated by the descriptions he received from these soldiers, and he was the first to take the phenomenon of phantom limbs seriously. Prior to this, they had been regarded as purely in the mind, apparitions conjured up by loss and grief, like the apparitions of recently deceased children or parents. Weir Mitchell showed that the appearance of a phantom limb occurred in every patient who had an amputation, and he surmised that it was a sort of image or memory of the lost limb, a persistent neural representation of the limb in the brain. He first described the phenomenon in his 1866 short story, The Case of George Dedlow, published in The Atlantic Monthly. It was only some years later, in his 1872 book, Injuries of Nerves and Their Consequences, that he addressed his fellow physicians on the subject. The majority of amputees are able to will a movement, and apparently, to themselves, execute it more or less effectively. The certainty with which these patients describe their phantom motions and their confidence as to the place assumed by the parts moved are truly remarkable. The effect is apt to excite twitching in the stump. In some cases, the muscles which act on the hand are absent altogether. Yet in these cases, there is fully as clear and definite a consciousness of the movement of the fingers and of their change of positions as in cases where the muscles to the hand are partially preserved. Such phantom memories and images occur to some extent in almost all amputees, and may last for decades. Although the phantoms may be intrusive, or even painful, especially if the limb was painful immediately before amputation, they may also be of great service to the amputee, enabling him to learn how to move a prosthetic limb, or, in the case of Wittgenstein, determine the fingering of a piano piece. Before Weir Mitchell's account, phantom limbs were regarded as purely psychic hallucinations conjured up by bereavement, mourning, or yearning, comparable to the apparitions of loved ones that mourners may experience for some weeks after their loss. Weir Mitchell was the first to show that these phantom limbs were real, neurological constructs dependent on the integrity of the brain, the spinal cord, and the remaining proximal portions of the sensory and motor nerves to the limb, and that their sensation and motions were accompanied by excitation in all of these. That such an excitation in fact occurred during phantom motion was proved for him by its overflow into movements of the stump. Recent neurophysiology has confirmed Weir Mitchell's hypothesis that the entire sensory ideational motor unit is activated in phantom motions. Farsin Hamzai et al. In Germany described in 2001 how there can be striking functional reorganization in the cortex after the amputation of an arm, in particular cortical disinhibition and enlargement of the excitable area of the stump. We know that movement and sensation continue to be represented in the cortex when the limb is physically lost, and Hamzai et al.'s findings suggest that the missing limb's representation may be conserved and concentrated in the now enlarged, hyper-excitable stump area of the cortex. This might explain why, as Otten noted, Wittgenstein's stump moved in an agitated manner when he played with his phantom arm. The last few decades have seen great advances in neuroscience and biomechanical engineering, advances particularly pertinent to the Wittgenstein phenomenon, and engineers are developing highly sophisticated artificial limbs with delicate muscles, amplification of nerve impulses, servo mechanisms, and so on, that can be married to the still intact portion of the limb and allow phantom motions to be turned into real ones. The presence of strong phantom sensations and of willed phantom movements is indeed essential to the success of such bionic limbs. Thus it seems possible in the not-so-far-off future that a one-armed pianist may be fitted with such a limb, and with it be able to play the piano again. One wonders what Paul Wittgenstein or his brother would have thought of such a development. Ludwig Wittgenstein's final book speaks of our first grounding certainty as being the certainty of our bodies. Indeed, his opening proposition is, "If you do know that here is one hand, we'll grant you all the rest." Although Wittgenstein's On Certainty is well known to have been written in response to the ideas of the analytic philosopher G. E. Moore, one must wonder, too, whether the strange matter of his brother's hand, a phantom indeed, but real, effectual and certain, did not also play a part in inciting Wittgenstein's thinking. Chapter 22. Athletes of the Small Muscles. Musicians Dystonia. In 1997, I received a letter from a young Italian violinist who related to me how he had started playing the violin when he was 6, had gone on to the conservatory, and then embarked on a career as a concert violinist. But then, at the age of 23, he started to experience peculiar difficulties with his left hand, difficulties which, he wrote, have cut short my career and my life. Playing pieces of a certain degree of difficulty, he continued, I found that the middle finger was not responding to my commands, and imperceptibly tended to shift from the position where I wanted to place it on the string, affecting the pitch. He consulted a physician, one of many he was to consult in the years to come, and was told that the overwork of this hand had caused an inflammation of the nerves. He was advised to rest and desist from playing for 3 months, but this, he found, had no effect. Indeed, when he resumed playing, the problem had become worse, and the strange difficulty in controlling finger movement had spread to the fourth and fifth fingers. Now only the index finger remained unaffected. It was only when he played the violin, he stressed, that his fingers disobeyed him. They functioned normally in all other activities. He went on to describe an odyssey of 8 years, in which he had consulted physicians, physiotherapists, psychiatrists, therapists, and healers of every sort all over Europe. He had been given many diagnoses: strained muscles, inflamed tendons, trapped nerves. He had undergone carpal tunnel surgery, faradization of nerves, myelograms, MRIs, and a great deal of intensive physical therapy and psychotherapy, all to no avail. Now, at 31, he felt that he could no longer maintain any hope of resuming his career. He had a deep sense of bewilderment, too. He felt that his condition was organic, that in some way it came from his brain, and that if there were any peripheral factors, such as nerve injuries, these had at most played a subsidiary part. He had heard, he wrote, of other performers with similar problems. With almost all of them, a seemingly trivial problem had grown steadily more severe, resisted all attempts at treatment, and ended performance careers. I had received a number of similar letters over the years, and had always referred my correspondence to a neurologist colleague, Frank Wilson, who had written an important early paper in 1989, Acquisition and Loss of Skilled Movement in Musicians. As a result, Wilson and I had been corresponding about so-called focal dystonia in musicians for some time. The problems my Italian correspondent described were not, indeed, anything new. Such problems have been observed for centuries, not only in players of musical instruments, but in a variety of other activities that demanded continuous, rapid movements of the hands or other parts of the body over long periods. In 1833, Sir Charles Bell, the famous anatomist, gave a detailed description of the problems that could affect the hands of people who wrote incessantly, such as clerks in government offices. He later called this Scrivener's palsy, though it was already well recognized among such writers, who called it writer's cramp. Gowers, in his 1888 Manual of Diseases of the Nervous System, devoted 20 close-packed pages to discussing writer's cramp and other occupation neuroses, the generic term he adopted for a group of maladies in which certain symptoms are excited by the attempt to perform some oft-repeated muscular action, commonly one that is involved in the occupation of the sufferer. Among clerks who suffer writer's cramp, Gowers said, lawyers' clerks constitute an undue proportion. This is no doubt due to the cramped style in which they commonly write. On the other hand, writer's cramp is practically unknown among those who write more and under higher pressure than any other class, shorthand writers. Gowers attributed this freedom to their using a very free style of writing, generally from the shoulder, which is also adopted by them in longhand writing. Gowers spoke of the susceptibility of pianists and violinists to their own occupation neuroses. Other provocative occupations included those of painters, harpists, artificial flower makers, turners, watchmakers, knitters, engravers, masons, compositors, enamelers, cigarette makers, shoemakers, milkers, money counters, and zither players, a veritable tally of Victorian occupations. Gowers did not see these task-specific problems as benign. The disease, when well developed, is one in which the prognosis is always uncertain and often unfavorable. Interestingly, at a time when such symptoms were either ascribed to peripheral problems with muscles, tendons, or nerves, or seen as hysterical or mental, Gowers did not feel satisfied with either explanation, though he allowed that these factors could play a subsidiary role. He insisted, rather, that these occupational neuroses had an origin in the brain. One reason for this thought was the fact that, though different parts of the body could be afflicted, all the provocative occupations involved rapid, repetitive movements of small muscles. Another was the conjunction of inhibitory features, such as unresponsiveness or paralysis, with excitatory ones, abnormal movements or spasms, which increased the more one fought against the inhibition. These considerations disposed Gowers to see occupation neuroses as disorders of motor control in the brain, disorders he thought might involve the motor cortex. The functions of the basal ganglia were unknown at this time. Once occupation neuroses developed, there was little chance of continuing in the same occupation or profession. But despite the mysterious nature and crippling consequences of this condition, remarkably little attention was paid to it medically for almost a century. Though it was well known in the world of performing musicians that this dread condition could lie in wait for anyone, perhaps 1 in 100 musicians would be affected at some point in their career, a natural reserve, even secrecy, prevailed. To acknowledge an occupation-related cramp was close to professional suicide. It would be understood that one would have to give up performing and become a teacher, a conductor, perhaps a composer instead. Richard J. Lederman of the Cleveland Clinic has proposed that this may be what happened to Schumann, who developed a strange hand condition in his pianistic days, which, in desperation, he attempted to treat himself, and perhaps rendered irreparable by the use of a finger-stretching device. Not until the 1980s was this veil of secrecy finally torn away, with great courage, by 2 virtuoso pianists, Gary Graffman and Leon Fleischer. Their stories were remarkably similar. Fleischer, like Graffman, had been a child prodigy, and one of the preeminent pianists in the world from his teenage years. In 1963, at the age of 36, he found the fourth and fifth fingers of his right hand starting to curl under his hand when he played. Fleischer fought against this and continued to play, but the more he fought, the worse the spasm became. A year later, he was forced to give up performing. In 1981, in an interview with Jennifer Dunning in the New York Times, Fleischer gave a precise and graphic description of the problems that had put a stop to his performance, including the years of misdiagnosis and sometimes mistreatment he had received. Not the least of his problems when seeking treatment was not being believed, for his symptoms came on only with piano playing, and very few doctors had a piano in their office. Fleischer's public acknowledgement of his condition came soon after Grafman acknowledged his own problem in 1981, and this spurred other musicians to admit that they, too, had been having similar problems. It also stimulated the first medical and scientific attention to the problem in almost a century. In 1982, David Marsden, a pioneer investigator of movement disorders, suggested that writer's cramp was an expression of disordered function in the basal ganglia, and that the disorder was akin to dystonia. The term dystonia had long been used for certain twisting and posturing spasms of the muscles, such as torticollis. It is typical of dystonias, as of Parkinsonism, that the reciprocal balance between agonistic and antagonistic muscles is lost, and instead of working together as they should, one set relaxing as the others contract, they contract together, producing a clench or spasm. Marsden's suggestion was taken up by other researchers, most notably Hunter Fry and Mark Hallett at the National Institutes of Health, who launched an intensive investigation of task-specific focal dystonias, such as writer's cramp and musician's dystonia. But rather than thinking of these in purely motor terms, they wondered, too, whether rapid repetitive movements might cause a sensory overload, which could then cascade into a dystonia. At the same time, Frank Wilson, who had long been fascinated by the speed and skill of pianists' hands and the dystonic mishaps that could befall them, found himself thinking in general terms of the sort of control systems which would have to underlie the repeated, automatic performance of very fast, intricate sequences of small, precise finger movements, with the activity of agonist and antagonist muscles in perfect reciprocal balance. Such a system, involving the coordination of many brain structures, sensory and motor cortex, thalamic nuclei, basal ganglia, cerebellum, would be operating, he argued, at or close to its functional capacity. The musician in full flight, he wrote in 1988, is an operational miracle, but a miracle with peculiar and sometimes unpredictable vulnerabilities. By the 1990s, the tools had become available for a minute exploration of this question, and the first surprise, given that focal dystonia seemed to be a motor problem, was to find that cortical disturbances in the sensory system were indeed of crucial importance. Hallett's group found that the mapping of dystonic hands in the sensory cortex was disorganized both functionally and anatomically. These changes in mapping were greatest for the fingers which were most affected. With the onset of dystonia, the sensory representations of the affected fingers started to enlarge excessively and then to overlap and fuse, to de-differentiate. This led to a deterioration in sensory discrimination and a potential loss of control, which the performer, usually, would fight against by practicing and concentrating more, or by playing with more force. A vicious cycle would develop, abnormal sensory input and abnormal motor output exacerbating each other. Other researchers found changes in the basal ganglia, which, with the sensory and motor cortex, form an essential circuit for the control of movement. Were these changes caused by the dystonia, or were they in fact primary, disposing certain susceptible individuals to the problem? The fact that the sensory motor cortex in dystonic patients also showed changes on the normal side suggested that these changes were indeed primary, and that there was probably a genetic predisposition to dystonia, which might become apparent only after years of rapid, repetitive movements in adjacent muscle groups. In addition to genetic vulnerabilities, there may be, as Wilson has pointed out, significant biomechanical considerations. The shape of a pianist's hands and the way he holds them, for example, might play a part in determining whether or not, after years of intensive practice and performance, he gets a dystonia. The fact that similar cortical abnormalities can be experimentally induced in monkeys has allowed Michael Merzenich and his colleagues in San Francisco to explore an animal model of focal dystonia and to demonstrate the abnormal feedbacks in the sensory loop and the motor misfirings that, once started, grow relentlessly worse. Could the cortical plasticity that allows focal dystonia to develop also be used to reverse it? Victor Candia and his colleagues in Germany have used sensory retraining to re-differentiate the degraded finger representations. Though the investment of time and effort is considerable, and success is not certain, they have shown that, in some cases at least, this sensorimotor retuning can restore relative normality of finger movement and its representation in the cortex. A sort of perverse learning is involved in the genesis of focal dystonia, and once the mappings in the sensory cortex have gone wrong, a massive act of unlearning is needed if a healthier relearning is to occur. And unlearning, as all teachers and trainers know, is very difficult, sometimes impossible. An entirely different approach was introduced in the late 1980s. One form of botulinum toxin, which in large doses causes paralysis, had been used in tiny doses to control various conditions in which muscles are so tense or in such spasm that they can hardly be moved. Mark Hallett and his group were pioneers in the experimental use of Botox to treat musicians' dystonia, and they found that small, carefully placed injections might allow a level of muscular relaxation that did not trigger the chaotic feedback, the aberrant motor programs, of focal dystonia. Such injections, though not always effective, have enabled some musicians to resume playing their instruments. Botox does not remove the underlying neural and perhaps genetic disposition to dystonia, and it may be unwise or provocative to attempt to return to performance. This was the case, for example, with Glenn Estrin, a gifted French horn player who developed an embouchure dystonia affecting the muscles of the lower face, jaw, and tongue. Though dystonias of the hand usually occur only in the particular act of making music, this is why it is called task-specific, dystonias in the lower face and jaw may be different. Stephen Frucht and his colleagues, in a pioneer study of 26 professional brass and woodwind players affected with this type of dystonia, observed that in more than a quarter of them, the dystonia spread to other activities. This happened with Estrin, who developed disabling mouth movements not only when playing the horn, but when eating or speaking, severely disabling him in daily life. Estrin has been treated with Botox, but has stopped playing, given the danger of recurrence and the disabling nature of his symptoms. Instead, he has turned his attention to working with musicians with dystonia, a group that he and Frucht founded in 2000 to publicize the condition and help musicians who are struggling with it. A few years ago, musicians like Fleischer and Grafman, or the Italian violinist who wrote to me in 1997, might go for years without a proper diagnosis or treatment, but now the situation has been transformed. Neurologists are much more aware of musicians' dystonia, as are musicians themselves. Recently, Leon Fleischer came to visit me a few days before he was to give a performance at Carnegie Hall. He spoke of how his own dystonia had first hit him. "I remember the piece that brought it on," he began, and described how he had been practicing the Schubert Wanderer Fantasy for 8 or 9 hours a day. Then he had to take an enforced rest. He had a small accident to his right thumb and could not play for a few days. It was on his return to the keyboard, after this, that he noticed the fourth and fifth fingers of that hand starting to curl under. His reaction to this, he said, was to work through it, as athletes are often told to work through the pain. But pianists, he said, should not work through pain or other symptoms. I warn other musicians about this. I warn them to treat themselves as athletes of the small muscles. They make extraordinary demands on the small muscles of their hands and fingers. In 1963, however, when the problem first arose, Fleischer had no one to advise him, no idea what was happening to his hand. He forced himself to work harder, and more effort was needed as other muscles were brought into play. But the more he exerted himself, the worse it became, until finally, after a year, he gave up the struggle. "When the gods go after you," he said, "they really know where to strike." He had a period of deep depression and despair, feeling his career as a performer was over. But he had always loved teaching, and now he turned to conducting as well. In the 1970s, he made a discovery. In retrospect, he is surprised he did not make it earlier. Paul Wittgenstein, the dazzlingly gifted and immensely wealthy Viennese pianist who had lost his right arm in the Great War, had commissioned the great composers of the world, Prokofiev, Hindemith, Ravel, Strauss, Korngold, Britten, and others, to write piano solos and concertos for the left hand. And this was the treasure trove that Fleischer discovered, one that enabled him to resume his career as a performing artist, but now, like Wittgenstein and Grafman, as a one-handed pianist. Playing only with the left hand at first seemed to Fleischer a great loss, a narrowing of possibilities, but gradually he came to feel that he had been on automatic, following a brilliant but, in a sense, one-directional course. You play your concerts, you play with orchestras, you make your records. That's it, until you have a heart attack on stage and die. But now he started to feel that his loss could be a growth experience. Suddenly I realized that the most important thing in my life was not playing with two hands. It was music. In order to be able to make it across these last 30 or 40 years, I've had to somehow de-emphasize the number of hands or the number of fingers, and go back to the concept of music as music. The instrumentation becomes unimportant, and it's the substance and content that take over. And yet, throughout those decades, he never fully accepted that his one-handedness was irrevocable. "The way it came upon me," he thought, "might be the way it would leave me." Every morning for 30-odd years, he tested his hand, always hoping. Though Fleischer had met Mark Hallett and tried Botox treatments in the late 1980s, it seemed that he needed an additional mode of treatment in the form of Rolfing to soften up the dystonic muscles in his arm and hand, a hand so clenched that he could not open it, and an arm as hard as petrified wood. The combination of Rolfing and Botox was a breakthrough for him, and he was able to give a two-hand performance with the Cleveland Orchestra in 1996 and a solo recital at Carnegie Hall in 2003. His first two-handed recording in 40 years was entitled simply, Two Hands. Botox treatments do not always work. The dose must be minutely calibrated, or it will weaken the muscles too much, and it must be repeated every few months. But Fleischer has been one of the lucky ones, and gently, humbly, gratefully, cautiously, he has returned to playing with two hands, though never forgetting for a moment that, as he puts it, once a dystonic, always a dystonic. Fleischer now performs once again around the world, and he speaks of this return as a rebirth, a state of grace, of ecstasy. But the situation is a delicate one. He still has regular Rolfing therapy, and takes care to stretch each finger before playing. He is careful to avoid provocative, scaly music, which may trigger his dystonia. Occasionally, too, he will redistribute some of the material, as he puts it, modifying the fingering, shifting what might be too taxing for the right hand to the left hand. At the end of our visit, Fleischer agreed to play something on my piano, a beautiful old 1894 Bechstein Concert Grand that I had grown up with, my father's piano. Fleischer sat at the piano and carefully, tenderly, stretched each finger in turn, and then, with arms and hands almost flat, he started to play. He played a piano transcription of Bach's Sheep May Safely Graze, as arranged for piano by Egon Petri. Never in its 112 years, I thought, had this piano been played by such a master. I had the feeling that Fleischer had sized up the piano's character, and perhaps its idiosyncrasies, within seconds, that he had matched his playing to the instrument, to bring out its greatest potential, its particularity. Fleischer seemed to distill the beauty drop by drop, like an alchemist, into flowing notes of an almost unbearable beauty. And, after this, there was nothing more to be said. Part 4. Emotion, Identity, and Music. Chapter 23. Awake and Asleep. Musical Dreams. Like most people, I dream of music occasionally. Sometimes I have panicked dreams that I have to perform in public music that I have never played before. But generally, in my dreams, I am listening to or playing music I know well. And though I may be deeply affected by the music while I am dreaming, when I awake, I sometimes have only the recollection that I have dreamed of music, or of the feelings that went with it, without being able to say what the music actually was. But on two occasions in 1974, it was different. I was severely insomniac, and had been taking chloral hydrate, an old-fashioned hypnotic, in rather large doses. This disposed me to excessively vivid dreams, which could sometimes continue as a sort of quasi-hallucination even after waking. On one such occasion, I dreamed of the Mozart Horn Quintet, and this continued, delightfully, when I got up. I heard, as I never do with my normal musical imagery, every instrument clearly. The piece unfolded, played itself unhurriedly at its proper tempo in my mind. And then suddenly, as I was drinking a cup of tea, it stopped, vanished like the bursting of a bubble. During the same period, I had another musical dream, and this too continued into the waking state. Here, in contrast to the Mozart, I found something deeply disturbing and unpleasant about the music, and longed for it to stop. I had a shower, a cup of coffee, went for a walk, shook my head, played a mazurka on the piano, to no avail. The hateful, hallucinatory music continued unabated. Finally, I phoned a friend, Orlan Fox, and said that I was hearing songs that I could not stop, songs that seemed to me full of melancholy and a sort of horror. The worst thing, I added, was that the songs were in German, a language I did not know. Orlan asked me to sing or hum some of the songs. I did so, and there was a long pause. "Have you abandoned some of your young patients?" he asked, "or destroyed some of your literary children?" "Both," I answered. "Yesterday, I resigned from the children's unit at the hospital where I have been working, and I burned a book of essays I had just written. How did you guess?" "Your mind is playing Mahler's Kinder Totenlieder," he said, "his songs of mourning for the death of children." I was amazed by this, for I rather dislike Mahler's music, and would normally find it quite difficult to remember in detail, let alone sing any of his Kinder Totenlieder. But here my dreaming mind, with infallible precision, had come up with an appropriate symbol of the previous day's events, and in the moment that Orlan interpreted the dream, the music disappeared. It has never recurred in the 30 years since. In the curious intermediate states between waking and sleep, the hypnagogic state that may precede sleep, or the hypnopompic state that may follow awakening, free-floating reverie and dreamlike or hallucinatory apparitions are particularly common. These tend to be highly visual, kaleidoscopic, elusive, and difficult to remember. But but on occasion they may take the form of coherent musical hallucination. Later in 1974, I had an accident requiring surgery to one leg and was hospitalized for several weeks in a tiny windowless room that did not allow any radio reception. A friend brought me a tape recorder along with a single cassette of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. I played this constantly, dozens of times a day, and one morning, in that delicious hypnopompic state that follows waking, I heard the Mendelssohn playing. I was not dreaming, but fully aware that I was lying in a hospital bed and that my tape recorder was by my side. One of the nurses, I thought, must have put it on as a novel way of waking me up. Gradually, I surfaced, the music continuing all the while, until I was able to stretch out a sleepy hand to turn the recorder off. When I did this, I found that the machine was off. In the moment of realizing this and being startled into full wakefulness, the hallucinatory Mendelssohn abruptly ceased. I had never experienced coherent, continuous, perception-like music in hypnagogic or hypnopompic states before this, nor have I since. I suspect that it was a combination of events that tipped me into hearing music in this way. The almost non-stop exposure to Mendelssohn, which had supersaturated my brain, plus the hypnopompic state. But after speaking to a number of professional musicians about this, I find that intensely vivid musical imagery, or quasi-hallucination, is not uncommon in such states. Melanie Challenger, a poet who writes libretti for operas, told me that when she wakes from her afternoon siesta and is in a borderline state, she may experience very loud, very vivid orchestral music. It is like having an orchestra in the room. She is perfectly aware at such times that she is lying in bed in her own room and that there is no orchestra, but she can hear all the individual instruments and their combinations with a richness and a realness that she does not have with her ordinary musical imagery. She says that it is never a single piece that she hears, but a patchwork of musical fragments and musical devices stitched together, a sort of kaleidoscopic playing with music. Nonetheless, some of these hypnopompic fragments may stick in her mind and play an important role in her subsequent compositions. With some musicians, however, especially if there has been long and intensive incubation of a new composition, such experiences may be coherent and full of meaning, even providing the long sought-after parts of a major composition. Such an experience was described by Wagner, who wrote of how the orchestral introduction to Das Rheingold came to him, after long waiting, when he was in a strange quasi-hallucinatory twilight state. After a night spent in fever and sleeplessness, I forced myself to take a long tramp the next day through the hilly country, which was covered with pine woods. It all looked dreary and desolate, and I could not think what I should do there. Returning in the afternoon, I stretched myself, dead tired, on a hard couch, awaiting the long-desired hour of sleep. It did not come, but I fell into a kind of somnolent state, in which I suddenly felt as though I was sinking in swiftly flowing water. The rushing sound formed itself in my brain into a musical sound, the chord of E-flat major, which continued, re-echoed in broken forms. These broken forms seemed to be melodic passages of increasing motion, yet the pure triad of E-flat major never changed, but seemed, by its continuance, to impart infinite significance to the element in which I was sinking. I awoke in sudden terror from my doze, feeling as though the waves were rushing high above my head. I at once recognized that the orchestral overture to the Rheingold, which must have long lain latent within me, though it had been unable to find definite form, had, at last, been revealed to me. I then quickly realized my own nature. The stream of life was not to flow to me from without, but from within. Ravel noted that the most delightful melodies came to him in dreams, and Stravinsky said much the same. But there is no more poignant example of this than the one Berlioz provided in his memoirs. 2 years ago, At a time when my wife's state of health was involving me in a lot of expense, but there was still some hope of its improving, I dreamed one night that I was composing a symphony and heard it in my dream. On waking next morning, I could recall nearly the whole of the first movement, which was an allegro in A minor in 2-4 time. I was going to my desk to begin writing it down when I suddenly thought, if I do, I shall be led on to compose the rest. My ideas always tend to expand nowadays. This symphony could well be on an enormous scale. I shall spend perhaps 3 or 4 months on the work. I took 7 to write Romeo and Juliet, during which time I shall do no articles, or very few, and my income will diminish accordingly. When the symphony is written, I shall be weak enough to let myself be persuaded by my